Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, October 27th, 2020. We will begin on the front page with the headline, 147 New Cases in McLean County. Pritzker, there seems to be a COVID storm on the rise. This article is by Paul Sweech. Seven more Central Illinois residents with COVID-19 have died, and the state's rolling seven-day positivity rate hit 6.3% on Monday, the highest since June 2nd. There seems to be a COVID storm on the rise, and we have to get prepared, said Governor J.B. Pritzker in Peoria. Because of a resurgence in cases in the Metro East and suburban Cook County, IDPH and Pritzker announced mitigation moves in those areas, including no indoor dining and bar service and limiting events to 25 guests or fewer, or 25% of overall room capacity. So no matter where in Illinois you call home, as you go about your daily lives, remember that this is not over, Pritzker said. While there is a 97% recovery rate, meaning 97% of COVID-19 positive individuals are alive 42 days after diagnosis, according to IDPH, Pritzker said there are often lasting side effects for survivors. There are currently more than 2,500 Illinoisans in the hospital fighting this virus, and unfortunately, because we now have so many new people getting infected, that number will likely rise over the coming weeks, Pritzker said. Many of those people will survive, but many will have lasting damage to their lungs and other internal organs. Locally, county public health officials on Monday reported COVID-related deaths of a McLean County woman in her 80s, two LaSalle County women in their 80s, and four Tazewell County residents in their 80s and 90s. The McLean County woman was associated with a long-term care center, said Health Department Administrator Jessica McKnight, who didn't identify the facility. It follows three COVID-related fatalities reported by the County Health Department last week and means that 34 county residents have died of the novel virus since March. The Tazewell County deceased were a man in his 80s, a resident of Timber Creek Rehab and Healthcare in Pekin, which is experiencing a COVID outbreak, a woman in her 80s and a woman in her 90s, both residents of Generations at Riverview in East Peoria, also experiencing an outbreak, and a woman in her 90s who was not associated with a long-term care facility. The four deaths in Tazewell mean that 57 residents of that county have died of COVID since March, and 129 more people had been diagnosed with the virus since Friday, bringing that county's total to 2,677 cases. LaSalle County Health Department didn't release more information on that county's two new COVID deaths, which brought to 65 the number of LaSalle counties who have died of the virus since March. That health department also reported 27 new COVID cases, bringing that county's case total to 2,426. The new cases ranged from teenagers to people in their 90s. Statewide, the Illinois Department of Public Health reported 4,729 new COVID cases and 17 additional deaths, bringing the number of cases since March to 378,985 and the number of deaths to 9,522. The statewide positivity rate for cases as a percent of total tests for the 7 days ending Sunday was 6.3%, compared with 6.1% the day before. As of Sunday night, 2,638 people in Illinois were hospitalized with COVID, with 589 of them in intensive care and 238 on ventilators, IDPH said. In McLean County, McKnight also reported that 147 more people were diagnosed with the virus since Friday, meaning 4,170 county residents have had COVID since March 19th. Included in the total, in addition to the 34 deaths, were 11 people who were hospitalized, one fewer than on Friday. None are in intensive care. The 361 people isolating at home were 72 more than on Friday. 75 more people have been released from isolation, as McKnight reported that 3,764 have recovered, compared with 3,689 on Friday. McLean County's 7-day positivity rate, the percent of county residents who have tested positive for the virus in the last week, was 4.9%. That compares with 4.4% on Friday. Of more than 96,000 COVID tests of county residents since March, 4.3% have come back positive, unchanged from Friday. At the COVID-19 testing site at the McLean County Fairgrounds at 1106 Interstate Drive in Bloomington, 468 people were tested on Sunday, McLean County Emergency Management Agency reported. That site, operated by Roditis Laboratories, is open 9 to 5 daily, except holidays and during inclement weather. People may pre-register at testdirectly.com/McLean. Illinois State University reported that of 1,268 student tests performed on campus in the last week, 35 have come back positive for a positivity rate of 2.8%. Of 14,469 student tests on campus since August 17th, 1,439 have been positive for a COVID positivity rate of 9.9%. That cumulative positivity rate had consistently exceeded 10%. ISU also reported that 1,401 students have recovered from the virus. ISU President Larry Dietz, in a message to the campus community, warned against COVID fatigue and urged people not to let their guard down. "Today, I am asking you to double down and do everything you can to prevent a coronavirus resurgence in our community and at Illinois State University," Dietz said in Monday's message, posted online and emailed to faculty, students, and staff. "Student adherence to COVID protocols and enhanced testing, tracing, and cleaning on campus have contributed to a decline in ISU COVID cases," he said. But he warned, "If we let our guard down, even for a moment, those numbers could jump to the same levels they reached almost 2 months ago." Elsewhere in central Illinois, Ford County Health Department reported 11 new cases, with 6 associated with an outbreak at Piper City Rehab and Living Center in Piper City. That health department also announced 2 COVID-related deaths, but they were reported by the state and the Pantograph on Sunday. Livingston County Health Department reported 40 new cases since Friday to bring its case total to 680, and Logan County Health Department reported 25 new cases, bringing their total to 597. We'll focus again on the virus with this headline: U.S. virus cases on the rise. Almost every state sees increase despite president's assurances. This is by Lisa Marie Payne and Mike Stobie with the Associated Press. Deaths per day from the coronavirus in the U.S. are on the rise again, just as health experts had feared, and cases are climbing in practically every state, despite assurances from President Donald Trump over the weekend that we're, quote, rounding the turn, we're doing great, close quote. With Election Day just over a week away, average deaths per day across the country are up 10% over the past 2 weeks, from 721 to nearly 794 as of Sunday, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. Newly confirmed infections per day are rising in 47 states, and deaths are up in 34. Also on Monday, a day after White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows said, we're not going to control the pandemic, a top Trump administration health official said that Americans have already proven they can control it through basic safeguards shown to work. I think we can control the pandemic, Assistant Secretary for Health Administration Brett Guerrier said on a call with reporters. I want to be clear that what we have done, what the American people have done, has been able to put out very significant outbreaks all across the Deep South, he said. He underscored what he calls the three W's: watch your distance from other people, wear a mask when you can't keep away, and wash your hands frequently. Guerrier said that while such simple measures cannot completely defeat the virus, they can control it. The nail in the coffin for the coronavirus will come when vaccines are approved and widely distributed, he added. Health experts had warned that it was only a matter of time before deaths turned upward, given the record-breaking surge in cases engulfing the country. Michael Osterholm, a University of Minnesota expert on infectious diseases, who warned over the summer of a fall surge, said, "What's happening now is a confluence of three factors: pandemic fatigue among people who are weary of hunkering down and are venturing out more, pandemic anger among those who don't believe the scourge is a real threat, and cold weather, which is forcing more Americans indoors where the virus can spread more easily." A local story on the front page is entitled "Feel at Home. Westminster Village's Assisted Living Area Expanded, Relocated" by Paul Sweech. Mary Alice Smith's home has been expanded, upgraded, and relocated, and she couldn't be happier. "Oh, this is much nicer," Smith, 93, said on Friday. "Look at this beautiful furniture. You feel like you're in a hotel." "I just feel at home," she said. Smith is a resident of Westminster Village's assisted living area, which has been expanded and relocated into a new building as part of the Continuing Care Retirement Community's two-phase, four-year, $62 million expansion and renovation project at 2025 East Lincoln Street. The latest development has been relocating residents such as Smith from her former assisted living building into the new building. Those moves were completed earlier this month. The reaction of residents like Smith have been positive, said Westminster CEO Barb Nathan. "They love the windows. They love the improved lighting," she said. "I don't think I've had any conversation with families where they didn't say it's breathtaking, and they appreciate Westminster Village taking the initiative to expand," said Director of Marketing Lacey Richcart. "It is a big investment, and they view it that way." Phase one of the expansion and renovation project, which began in 2017, included renovation of Westminster Common Areas, a new Martin Health Center skilled care building, and renovation of the existing Martin building. That work was completed last December. Phase two includes building the new assisted living and memory care building and renovating the previous assisted living rooms into independent living. The previous assisted living area had been built years ago as independent living apartments, so that building had long hallways, less accessible bathrooms, and fewer common areas, Nathan said. The 60 new assisted living building apartments, including their bathrooms, have a more open floor plan for easier navigation and more common areas to engender community. Every 12 apartments have a common space for people to gather, and each is large enough to allow for social distancing during the COVID-19 pandemic, Nathan said. The assisted living building also includes a dedicated entrance, a social center that includes an exercise area, dining rooms, large windows, a multi-purpose room, and a private dining room and card room that will open post-COVID, as well as an outdoor activity area that will be developed into a park over the next year, Nathan said. Memory care is new to Westminster, and that area will open before the end of the year. As with the assisted living apartments, the 12 memory care apartments include a more open floor plan and large bathrooms. The hallway is configured as a loop for residents who like to stay in movement and includes tactile handrails, which people with dementia may find soothing. Off the dining room is a secure outdoor space. This was the priority when we started this project, Nathan said. We wanted to add memory care to this campus, and we wanted a new assisted living building. This puts assisted living into the center of our campus, connected to Martin Healthcare Center and to the common areas of Westminster Village, she said. We are a community. Putting assisted living at the center of the community made sense. This is a fulfillment of that dream. Renovating the existing assisted living rooms into independent living apartments began October 5th and will be done in spring 2021, said Scott Fair, project manager with PJ Hoare. 54 assisted living apartments are being converted into 48 independent living apartments, 16 one-bedroom units and 32 two-bedroom units to respond to the demand for larger two-bedroom apartments, Rickart said. At this point, we are under budget and on schedule for phase one and phase two, Nathan said. The project has gone very well. When you consider that in 4 years, as of next spring, we will have completed six additions and renovations of every common area, that's an incredible amount of work in 4 years. This has been one of the best projects that PG Hoare has ever had, Fair said. When the project is over, it will have added 86 units to the Westminster campus and 50 more employees, Nathan said. But what's more important is how existing residents, such as Smith, this is their home, Nathan said, and they love their home. Next, we'll turn to some election news. Four candidates for 105th and 88th districts discuss issues. This is by Annalisa Trofimuk. The response to the coronavirus pandemic, healthcare, and police reform are key issues for candidates running for General Assembly seats in the 105th and 88th districts on November 3rd. Dan Brady, Republican incumbent of the 105th district, said one of his goals is to continue to work hard on behalf of his constituents in every aspect. Democratic challenger Chamberlain Cummings said she is running the platform of reviving Illinois communities so that they are strong and energetic. The district covers a portion of Bloomington, Normal, Lexington, Hudson, Carlock, and other central Illinois communities. Carla Bailey Smith is running to represent the 88th district as an active and effective leader. Republican incumbent Keith Summer, who was first elected in 2012, did not return requests for comment. The district covers Bloomington, Morton, Washington, and some surrounding areas. In the 105th district, the question on coronavirus, Brady referenced his actions towards securing free COVID-19 testing in McLean County. A testing site at the county fairgrounds opened March 28th and was staffed by the roughly 50 members of the National Guard. Not only did I get an extension for the National Guard to stay when they were about to pull out of being here, but I developed a plan to keep the testing site there, Brady said. He added that he would continue to make similar decisions so that all of the constituents can get the proper access to COVID resources. Cummings said she appreciated that the state has leadership that will listen to medical professionals when making decisions related to the pandemic. She said the next steps should include considering how to rebound when this is over, and that she would focus on rebounding small businesses so they have the opportunity to thrive. On police reform, we have reimagining community safety is a priority for Cummings, among healthcare and the response to COVID-19. She said she wants to evaluate how the state ensures the safety of citizens. We've seen bills come to the floor on sensitivity training, and none of it has gone through, Cummings said. She referenced several measures she would pursue, including adding mental health resources for officers, having shifts split so that officers don't have to be policing the streets for multiple shifts at a time, and adding requirements for police to live in communities where they serve, similar to what she recalls from her hometown in Cleveland, Ohio. It leaves you with a sense of community. Your perspective is different and you don't look like an outsider. Brady said he has already built a relationship with key groups in Bloomington Normal. I have open dialogue with local law enforcement and I'm part of and interact with the local NAACP, he said. Brady says those relationships will help him enact true reform and get substantial results in relation to police reform. In the 88th District, Bailey Smith talked about the 10 years she lived in London, where the national health system is paid for with value-added tax on goods and services. Private health care still exists in the UK, but most people enjoy preventative health care and necessary surgeries at no out-of-pocket cost, she said. States can lead the way. Smith said she wants to see healthcare as a right and the healthcare system changed to allow for those who can afford it to still pay for private care, but for the majority of us to have access to affordable or free comprehensive healthcare. Smith said she felt the state handled their response to COVID-19 well in the beginning, but there should have been a better plan in place for small businesses. We need to prioritize support for small businesses, which keep money circulating within our communities, Smith said. We might also need to have a freeze of rent and mortgages for rental property owners. She added that before public schools can open to entirely in person, there has to be state guidelines and protocols that all schools follow for testing, contact tracing, and rules for quarantine. We also need to look at better support for childcare as schools turn into hybrid models, she said. On police reform, some of the workload should be taken off police, according to Smith. We need social workers to respond to calls regarding mental health, homelessness, and drug addiction, said Smith. We can allow our police to spend more time investigating serious crimes if we work to change laws that criminalize being poor or being addicted to drugs. Homelessness, mental health problems, and drug addiction should not be reasons people are interacting with the police. Implicit bias and de-escalation training should be state requirements, Smith said. Years of systemic racism has cemented in many minds that a person of color is suspicious, is more likely to be a criminal, she said. Here in McLean County, people of color are stopped by police disproportionately. This is because of implicit bias, and we need to change these views and this behavior. In Bloomington City News, we have Council Expands Duties of Oversight Board by Annalisa Trofimuk. The City Police Advisory Board is getting more duties. The Bloomington City Council on Monday voted 5-4 to expand the responsibilities of the Public Safety and Community Relations Board. The board was created in 2017 at the request of an alliance of community organizations, including Not in Our Town, American Civil Liberties Union of Central Illinois, the NAACP, YWCA of McLean County, and Black Lives Matter Bloomington Normal. The group serves as an advisory board to the police chief and city manager, providing feedback from community members about training, operations, and policy. New duties include building community outreach, anticipating and preventing problems, and making recommendations to the city based on public input and analysis of data. The vote came after a lengthy conversation about the role of the panel. Ward 9 Alderwoman Kim Bray, who was on council when the advisory board was created, said similar recommendations were considered when it was established. Bray said she wasn't sure if the board needed change because of the low ratio of complaints. She said she instead would like for the council to work with the community to meet their needs in a different format. Bray motioned to have the ordinance denied. Ward 1 alderperson Jamie Mathie, who was also on the council in 2017, disagreed with Bray's assessment of the resolution. Ward 3 alderperson Mboka Mwambwe said the items should be considered during a future meeting when they could further discuss the amendment. It's going to build a long time to build a culture of trust for the complaints to come forth, said Ward 6 alderperson Jen Carrillo. She added that while the city has a low rate of complaints, that doesn't mean there are not things to complain about, but that some could still be uncomfortable with coming forward. Ward 7 alderperson Scott Black said he was heartened to hear how many community organizations came to Bloomington to have a board enacted, but did not take the same approach with the normal and McLean County governments. Ward 4 alderperson Julie Emig said the amendment would be in alignment with the original ordinance. I don't see it as divisive at all. I think it's another attempt to layer transparency and a way to look at what is happening to everyone in the community, Emig said. All of the council members voted against Bray's motion to have the ordinance denied. Bray was the only member to vote yes. That motion failed. I think it's premature to start adding language, said Bray. Carrillo, Black, Craybill, and Emig voted for the amendment, and Ward 2 alderperson Donna Bolin voted no, along with Ward 5 alderpeople Joni Painter, Malambwe, and Bray. Next, we have McClintock to Run for Mayor by Alyssa Trofimek. Bloomington resident Nick McClintock is running for mayor in the April election. I've lived here in this community or next door in Normal for my entire life, McClintock said in a Facebook video announcing his candidacy. And I feel that gives me a unique perspective, both as a lifelong resident and as a younger individual, for what the needs are for this community for the short term, as well as seeing us into the future. McClintock says he plans to release more information after the November 3rd general election. Mayor Terry Renner announced last week he will not seek a third term. Also, woman charged in 2018 domestic battery by Kelsey Watznauer. Battery charges are pending against a Normal woman after she was brought in on a 2-year-old warrant. Angel W. Brackens, 37, is charged with aggravated domestic battery and domestic battery, which is a felony for a subsequent offense. According to court documents, the offenses occurred October 17, 2018, and caused injuries, including lacerations that required stitches after the victim was struck with a glass. A warrant for her arrest was issued December 12, 2018, and she was taken into custody on Friday. Brackens is jailed in lieu of posting $7,500 in this case, and an arraignment is scheduled for November 20th. Kelsey Watznauer also writes, man charged with drug-induced homicide. A Bloomington man is in custody on charges of drug-induced homicide connected to a June 2019 heroin delivery. Anthony P. Foreman, 38, is charged with drug-induced homicide and 2 counts of unlawful delivery of less than 1 gram of heroin. According to court documents, the McLean County State's Attorney's Office has accused him of delivering the drug that caused the death of a person. The person's death was caused by injection, inhalation, absorption, or ingestion of the heroin he is accused of delivering on June 17, 2019, which accounts for 1 of the 2 counts of drug delivery. A different person was named in court files as the recipient in the other drug transaction. A warrant for his arrest was issued Friday, and he was taken into custody by Normal officers on Saturday. Foreman was jailed in lieu of posting $50,000 bond, and an arraignment was scheduled for November 20th. That concludes the first half of the Pantograph for Tuesday, October 27th, 2020. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with the second half.